You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, currently situated in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Seth Paskin from Austin, Texas.
And this is Wes Allwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
The topic for episode number 4 is The Absurdity of Life, focusing on readings by Albert Camus, including The Myth of Sisyphus and his essay An Absurd Reasoning. Listen to our other fine episodes and get links to online versions of the readings we discuss. Check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast from iTunes. On the website, you'll see a link to our Facebook discussion group where you can contact us and engage us in riveting online discussion. And now, may I present the ground rules for our discussion to be revised for future episodes contingent upon our whims. Number 1, we do not assume that our audience, you, knows anything about any of this, any philosophy, any... even the English language. We don't assume that you know anything. Number 2, no gratuitous name-dropping. We're interested in ideas, not with fetishizing a bunch of dead philosophers. If you have a point to make, just make it. You can't say, you know, you'll understand what I mean if you go read St. Barnabas of Buchenwald's Ecclesiastical Implications of Aspartame. Number 3, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except in cases where not doing so seems like it would be more entertaining. I don't think I was very clear when I was trying to tell you guys what to read in the first place. The book is The Myth of Sisyphus and Other Essays. The first essay in it is entitled An Absurd Reasoning.
Right.
And the first subdivision of that is Absurdity and Suicide. But it doesn't actually get around to telling you why you should not commit suicide until around the last section of An Absurd Reasoning, Absurd Freedom.
You're right. It's a collected essays, but I always think of it as The Myth of Sisyphus.
Even though The Myth of Sisyphus itself is like 4 pages long. Yes, yeah. It's a little tiny little bit.
You know, this is one of the things I taught at the University of Texas, actually.
Really?
Well, awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, taught teaching assisted. Assisted teaching.
You can say taught. It's okay.
So, I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty sure I'd read The Myth of Sisyphus and maybe some other stuff by Camus, but I'd never fully read Absurdity and Suicide. And I was anticipating something quite different than what I got. I have to say that I did not enjoy the reading nearly as much as I thought I was going to, because it seemed like I really had to wade through a lot of verbiage to just get some basic principles about what he was trying to get to. And then, you know, talk about if you think Wes is bad about dropping names, this thing is full of reference. I mean, Chestov? Really? Really? It was just a very difficult read for me because I felt like he would lead up and I'd finally get to a point where I'm like, okay, now I get it. You are saying that the absurd life is this and suicide is a response or solution in this way. And then there would be like 15 pages of him going off on tangents about things. And it was very difficult.
Yeah, it needs skimming.
See, because I think you guys might talk at length about this, I'm going to sheepishly admit that I really enjoyed the reading. And as someone who hates verbiage and the French in particular, not the French, but French intellectually, I still love this reading, so it's interesting. And then, you know, I thought he explained Chestov, and, you know, and of course there's Kierkegaard too. He's trying to differentiate his brand of existentialism from theirs.
I had to peck at it. That is, so I had taught recently an abridged version of this, which just had, you know, the beginning where he talks about suicide and then a few parts selected from the end and then the Myth of Sisyphus thing itself. But the whole thing totaled about 5 pages and it was totally lucid and it was very nice. When I was teaching that, I looked online. I saw, okay, well, the rest of the argument for why you should not commit suicide is not in this part that we read. So I need to at least pull some quotes out of the full text. So I thought we should look at the full text. When I was actually wading through it myself, you know, So I'd already had that first pass from teaching it before. So I started to sink in a little more and then kind of glaze over some sections and skip to, okay, where's the next major heading? I'll read a little more of that. Finally, I had gotten through the whole thing such that I was able to go back and just fill in all the gaps. And I thought it was a little redundant, but in some ways that's just trying to enumerate his point in several different ways. And as Wes was saying, to situate himself among the different philosophers. So I did finally come away with it with a pretty solid understanding, I think, of his main point, which is not that complicated, as opposed to all the maybe smaller points, the individual sentences, some of which were absolutely bewildering.
Yeah, it's hard for me to explain why this doesn't, you know, this is the kind of reading that might really have bothered me. You know, there are sentences like, these are again truisms and little sort of pretentious or kind of arrogant flourishes, which when I'm trying to read someone like Lacan, for instance, they're little hints of that. It's sort of a French style, I think. I can't even read Lacan without becoming so furious. I just can't. I can't read it. It creates... And so, for whatever reason, I think it's just the subject matter. I'm looking beyond that. But so there's more charity with this than I typically have. But
yeah. Well, I'll tell you the other thing that's kind of, and this is kind of in line with that, Wes, is that he leads off saying there is one critical philosophical question you have to answer before all others, right? You know, who cares about whether what is and what's true and what's not true? If life isn't worth living, then all the other questions are meaningless, right? Or secondary. And then we're treated to like 50 pages of him talking about theories of phenomenology and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, hey, man, you got me, right? Okay, I'm hooked. Now get to the meat of the matter. And I think that was the thing, was it took so long to get the point that I was like, he's not stylistically impressing upon me the importance of this question.
Let me give the 30-second version. See if you agree with this as the structure, sort of echoing over the whole essay, which is, first is this discovery that life is absurd. And he says that that's not really his point in this essay, to prove that life is absurd. This is just something that everybody already recognizes. And so he gives us many examples of, and we can come up with more ourselves, of situations in which the absurd arises. The most obvious, which is our own impending death. The fact that we will eventually die, so all of our goals and things that we've set up for ourselves are kind of silly and meaningless given that. Then there are many others. So if he thinks that anyone who's intellectually honest will recognize that life is absurd because of things like this, then he's asking, what should we do about that? Should we commit suicide if we're all going to die anyway? Maybe it's just stupid. We should just stop living right now. We might as well get it over with. And he considers a lot of different options, which he thinks are all flavors of the same thing. But it comes down to, absurdity is a relation between our minds and the world, and the fact that they don't match up in lots of ways, right? So we have, for instance, this desire to unify everything, to understand everything, but really nature is at its core unknowable. And lots of other philosophers like Kant have shown this, that we can do science, we can learn things about appearances, but we can't really learn things about reality itself. Or another way of putting it is, if we have certain expectations of fairness of the world, but these are not borne out in the uncaring universe itself. So given all these things, it's a relational concept between us and our reason and the other things that we have at our disposal versus this vast, uncaring world. And there's a tension between those things. And he says the proper response, the only response that is morally admirable to him, is to keep this tension going. So if you come up with a philosophy that somehow denies the absurd, that if you say, well, it seems like everything is crazy out there, but God is there, and God will enfold us in his arms, and we don't have to understand anything, then that's copping out. That's denying one of the terms of the absurd relationship, which is of the irrational world.
And it's its own kind of suicide.
Yes. But if we decide instead to kill ourselves, well, that's getting rid of the other term. So we need to keep both of those terms in there, and he talks about this in a bunch of different ways, but this just magnificent friction between the two, and that's really what the best kind of life, in fact, recognizing that and keeping it firmly in mind is just a prerequisite for any other kind of greatness. So you shouldn't commit suicide, because that's wussing out, and you shouldn't buy into some easy philosophy like almost any religion, he seems to say, because that's also wussing out.
Great summary.
Yeah.
I think we're done with this conversation, aren't we? No, there's a lot more there, but that was great.
Yeah, that was really nice. I mean, I picked up on a number of those points, but I think you brought it together very nicely, Mark.
Well, because he does take, as you said, 60 pages to get to the end of the argument.
Well, and the thing is I kept expecting this to be kind of an argument against suicide, and it really isn't, because he basically says, suicide is a solution to the absurd. It settles it. It solves the problem, right?
But in a bad way.
But in a bad way, yeah. Because you're accepting it instead of revolting against it.
Right.
Exactly. It's for those two things to remain unreconciled. That's what makes you cool.
Right.
And then you just die in a motorcycle accident. So, accidentally.
Yes.
That's how he dies, right?
Camus died in a motorcycle accident?
Yeah, he died young in a motorcycle accident, ironically, after...
That's nice. There is a line in there where he says, it is essential to die unreconciled and not of one's own free will.
Yeah.
And he made a big point in the beginning about people who act on their philosophical judgment. So the people who determined that life wasn't worth living and went ahead and killed themselves, there's like a little small catalog early on of like three guys, I think he says, that did it. But he complains about Galileo bailing like as soon as the church was like...
It's not a complaint.
No, he approves of that.
He approves of it.
He approves of it on the one hand because...
Explain the example just for a second, though.
Well,
let's go to the actual...
Most people know this.
...text here.
Oh, okay.
He calls him effeminate for doing that as well. it depends in the footnote. So I have never seen anyone die for the ontological argument. So he's talking about the sort of
lack of urgency
to those. So Galileo held a scientific truth of great importance, abjured it with the greatest ease. He did right. Truth was not worth the stake. But in the footnote, that's from the point of view of the relative value of truth. On the other hand, from the point of view of virile behavior, the scholar's fragility may well make us smile. Anyway, I thought that was great. So that's, sorry, Seth.
I like that too. So all I'm saying is that at least Camus was consistent. He died not of his own free will, and he was unreconciled, yeah. I'm sure, when it happened.
And probably drunk. But and
if you're, yeah, exactly.
In a
if you're negligent,
jacket and anyway,
how crazy can you act before it is considered suicidal behavior?
I was thinking about that.
If you die, the fact that you're on a motorcycle at all, like I'm not ripping people who drive motorcycles, but it's not the safest way to travel. And I would bet he was not wearing a helmet. I don't know.
I think he was really closing the gap a little bit between the two poles.
I think he was on the Autobahn, going as fast as the bike would go, standing with one foot on the handlebar and one foot on the seat, going, whoa, man!
He probably had a girl behind him.
This is all slander. All slander.
You're romanticizing. It's Albert Camus, not James Dean. All right, so let's at least begin with the kind of beginning question, right, where he says, it's legitimate and necessary to wonder whether life has a meaning. Therefore, it's legitimate and necessary to meet the problem of suicide face to face. So in leading up to this conversation, I had lunch with a few friends, and I mentioned that we were going to cover this subject, and we were kind of talking about suicide. And they were saying that it's absolutely legitimate that there are certain people that have just tremendous emotional pain and that there's a certain validity for those people to escape the mental pain that they're in, you know, to commit suicide. I suppose physical pain falls in that category too. And we were talking about why people would commit suicide. So there's kind of escape from pain, you know, and then there's people who can't deal with the circumstances that they've found themselves in. They don't feel like they can do whatever is necessary to deal with it. I'm not sure that even right off the bat, this connection between life having meaning and suicide is that strong for me. I think there's certainly plenty of people that could say, well, yeah, you know, it's a silly stage that we all come and dance like puppets on and then we're gone. But that in itself is somehow entertaining. And the act of being alive is in itself sufficient, whether or not there's any meaning behind it or not, because of my experience, you know, I enjoy the experience of it. So,
yeah, well, and that's what I think what Camus, that's what he ends up saying.
You are the absurd man, Seth.
Right? Quantity of life. That is, you know, this only becomes a question when we break out of life and we start sort of asking these fundamental questions. I guess he says, first of all, that, yes, you should do that because you're just an unreflective animal if you don't, and you're not a respectable philosopher who would be... You're not really even a fully human, I think. But doesn't it seem like the ultimate solution, I don't want to just jump ahead of this whole thing, though, is that even though we recognize the absurd, we're able to find meaning day-to-day in just activities we choose, it's just that we realize that it's kind of arbitrary. You know, there's no reason I should get excited about the new Star Trek movie, but, okay. I can find meaning enough in that to stay alive. And that the fact that there's meaning all over the place, you can just fall into it.
I think we need to think about what we mean by meaning here, which is a difficult question. Because on the one hand, there's a reason why people are, for instance, religious and why they are willing to die for those ideals, which is really the this is he talks about Nietzsche, so there's some background in Nietzsche here. Nietzsche's primary concern was why a saint, for instance, is willing to give his life for an idea, especially if you think that the primary motive of living is pleasure and that people are just out to enjoy themselves. Well, human behavior seems to contradict that.
He's psychologically fucked up, right? I mean, that's what Nietzsche says, ultimately, that people say that they're dying for an idea or something, but it's because they're just fucked up, and so they adopt destructive ideas.
Well, it's will to power, so it's one form. It's a workaround. If you can't exert power in the real world, if you're not one of the blonde beasts, as he calls them, one of the knights going around slaughtering the peasants, then you come up with your slave morality, which is a kind of fantasy of power. So it's this version of will to power for the weak, where they come up with their ideology. So you have religion, and then God's going to take vengeance. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth, and so on and so forth. And this is, for those listeners who are interested in Nietzsche's genealogy of morality, all of this is outlined, and there's some indirect references in this essay to that. So I think this is an extension of going beyond the idea of why it is that people die for these ideals. Is there a way to live without these ideals? And I think that becomes tricky, because even if you think you're immune to them, even if you say, well, I'm not religious, and so on and so forth, they may slip in ways that you don't realize. So someone caught up in the excitement of being a Nazi in Germany might not have thought of themselves as someone fundamentally religious, but falling into that kind of sentiment, arguably you could be elevating an idea above these immediate experiences that Camus talks about.
Well, now you've got me thinking along these Nietzschean lines, and even you don't even need the whole genealogy of moral story to get Nietzsche's suspicion. So this is not name-dropping, because really I found myself in reading this like, mm-hmm. Is Camus just being Nietzsche light?
Right.
You know, is he just taking a few of the insights of Nietzsche and running with him a little bit? So Nietzsche seems to be very suspicious of all intellectual arguments, that really, when somebody puts forward a moral theory like utilitarianism or Kantianism or something like that, you sort of ask, well, what kind of person would adopt that? Like, so it's sort of like people adopt ideas that already go with the state of their spirit, with the state of their mental health. And so somebody on this case, you know, somebody that is anti-life, so that either wants to commit suicide themselves or adopts a philosophy that denigrates daily life. So, for instance, he thinks Christianity mm-hmm. does that because heaven is important. You know,
right.
Heaven is where God is hanging out. This life, it's all just illusory. And he thinks most religions have some version of that, where they're crapping on.
And also philosophy in general, and even science. Because all of these things
yep.
elevate this concept of the other world, or let's say truth in the case of
the
science.
Eternal.
The
yep.
eternal. So all of those things have the same character for Nietzsche. So you can't escape the accusation of needing meaning in life by saying, oh, I'm just a scientist and I'm into the hard facts. Well, you know, you're still escaping in that way.
Yep. So Camus is making a lot of these same criticisms here.
Yeah.
But if he wants to say that suicide is a choice you could make with complete intellectual honesty, you know, at least I'm not saying he thinks that's the right choice, but that, you know, Nietzsche on suicide would seem to say that anybody who's thinking about committing suicide is just because they're already kind of messed up and hating life, and they might use a philosophical excuse. Oh, life is absurd. I must do away with myself. But it's just an excuse. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and Camus does say this, you know, when people that commit suicide, typically it's sort of a decision that's made subconsciously. Like, their life is being undermined. They're getting themselves ready. It might have been a tragedy that happened to them, you know, a while ago, but sort of gradually as time goes on, they make this decision with the whole of their being before it even necessarily becomes a conscious thing. I'm not sure I buy that description. I don't, you know, that seems like, check with the clinical people whether this fits the profile. But so, I mean, does it really seem like Camus is saying here that, you know, a legitimate, philosophically respectable person could seriously be contemplating suicide in, you know, in a way that's not just that their emotions are sneaking in? Seth, give us the roundtable discussion verdict.
I think there's a certain perception, at least amongst, so, you know, the people I hang around with in a lot of ways because of my connection to my nonprofit, there are a lot of social workers and people who are sort of aligned with social work kind of activities. And suicide is obviously considered something that's extremely tragic, and they're very empathetic for people who feel that as a solution. At the same time, they under no circumstances could condone it for any reason whatsoever, right? And I know plenty of people who call it the coward's way out, and get people who have had folks in their family commit suicide and are very angry about it, right? You know, that they feel they've been deprived and all that. I think what's kind of striking me about this that I'm trying to reconcile as we kind of kick it off is, what is life having meaning and suicide? What is the connection exactly? Because he's basically saying there's a couple steps in between. So if life has no meaning, then life is not worth living, or it's not worth the trouble, right? And if it's not worth living or not worth the trouble, then suicide is the appropriate action, right?
Well, that's the assumption that he wants to do away with. In other words, and I'm looking at that not worth the trouble page right now. I'm not sure that he wants to evaluate whether or not someone who commits suicide is a coward, or whether that's the wrong way to go. But more importantly, they haven't given up the idea of meaning. So far from this sort of stereotype of the suicide as being someone who's merely given up, they need it so badly that they have to do away with themselves rather than live with that realization that there's none there. And so I think the thing that Camus is advocating is to get rid of that assumption altogether, to get rid of this idea of the meaning of life as a condition for existence. But I think, Seth, that we could ask the question, why does it seem to be there in the first place for people? What is meaning? I mean, what do we mean by the meaning of life, and what are we seeking if there is some sort of propensity to seek that?
Yeah, so Wes, just taking from what you just said, what I'm hearing is maybe he's addressing a certain subset of people, or he's addressing a certain situation that people might find themselves in where they crave meaning, they need meaning in order to justify their existence, but they come to the realization that life has no meaning. This thing that, as Mark pointed out, he kind of assumes without debate, right?
Well, I think he thinks that we're all like that. It's not just some people, that all of us have this built-in need for meaning, or desire for meaning, and for things to make sense. And in fact, if we deny that's sort of getting rid of one of the parts of the relation.
Yes. No. I agree, Mark. What I'm saying is that, so we assume that everybody has this craving for meaning, but not everybody has come to the realization that, in fact, life is absurd.
Sure.
So, you know, he's almost in some sense addressing the people in this essay that have recognized this craving for meaning, this need for meaning in themselves, and simultaneously recognized the absurdity of life. And he's saying, okay, if you're at this point and you're that kind of person, then you might be asking yourself, should I commit suicide? And let me tell you why not.
I think he thinks that anybody that's been thinking at his point in history has reached the point where they recognize absurdity. And he wants to give us, you know, that's all the way back to Shakespeare. Anybody just realizes their own death. And certainly now, at this point in history, he thinks that it's pretty much unforgivable that you should not recognize these things. And he gives us a couple thought experiments. Do you want to just talk about some of those examples? So we talked about death already.
Well, there's the one, I don't think this is the thought experiment, but he says all healthy men having thought of their own suicide, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But then I think you mentioned that word undermined. That's just a great little vignette in and of itself. The apartment building manager killed himself. So I was told he had lost his daughter 5 years before, that he had changed greatly since, and that this experience had undermined him. So I find that very interesting. So there are experiences that can bring anyone to that feeling or thought that it's just not worth the trouble.
Mark, you mentioned Shakespeare at some point not too long ago. Mm-hmm. So we know that, you know, the great love story, Romeo and Juliet, happens to end in a couple of suicides for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with this, or do they?
Well, he's a Shakespeare quote somewhere in here. I was more thinking Hamlet.
Mm, okay.
To be or not to be, the contemplating suicide.
And then we could also think about the tale told by an idiot as far as the general idea of a meaning of life, you know. But a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Because there the idea is that the significance of life, it's not about significance necessarily to us. It's the idea of the significance going, you know, when we talk about meaning, we're usually talking about, well, the word dog means this, or so on and so forth. The expansion of this concept of meaning is kind of confusing when you think about it, because it's not just about, oh, yeah, there are things I like to do with my day, and that gives me meaning. It's this very broad idea where it's almost as if my life is meant to have meaning to someone else. And, of course,
well,
the solution to that is God.
It's not.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I would say it's not just the solution. It's the starting point why we're in this teleological framework in the first place. Right?
I think some
purposive descriptions.
I think, you know, and this is in Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals as well. God is the result of that need to be significant to someone else. You know, the fundamental psychology of it is that to have a sense of being or a sense of self-consciousness and a sense of integrity, you have to be conscious of someone else being conscious of you. Or, even as an extension of that, you have to feel desired by another, and you have to have the desire for that desire. This is a theme that extends through this concept of theodicy as well, which Camus alludes to. So, for instance, there's the question of, you know, the theodicy is just the justification of God's ways. In a world in which there is evil, how can there be an omnipotent God? And I'm reminded of something in Milton's attempt in Paradise Lost, and you can, again, cut this out if this is too much name-dropping. But
no,
to,
I'm just
going to
call you pretentious. I'm not
but to, yeah, just put in the... but no, it's because I think this is actually, this is important. It's, there is the explanation of the fall of man in terms of Eve's wanting to be seen by God. It's the flip side of this. You know, why does God create the universe? Well, he wants to have playthings, let's say. He has a sick sense of humor, but really because his world is a spiritual world and he wants the experience of things that are carnal. So God wants that experience. He creates bodily things and have it. And on the flip side of the fall is that someone like Eve eats the apple because she's not fully carnal. She hasn't become until she's completely fallen and seen that way. So there's this desire to be seen by God. And then just one more note. The idea in Nietzsche is that God isn't just the beginning point. God is sort of a solution to that idea of, because your parents are gone, there's no one there looking at your drawings and saying, oh, great job. And that need to be fully actualized depends upon this concept of being seen by another. And unless that's ensured and objectified and built up, so that's where I think that this notion of the meaning of life becomes interesting, of being meaningful to another.
See, I can totally see how that fueled religion becoming what it is today. The question is, you know, what caused what, and maybe this is not so important for us to get into now. I would imagine that it's much more likely that we had notions of gods and things way before we had notions of God is watching everything I do, and the inside of my mind is not just mine. It actually matters because it's a show I'm putting on for God, and if I have bad thoughts, God's going to be mad about that. Like, that seems like a way later... you know, fucked up version of religion from the old version, you know, the old time, which is God is like a big, powerful entity out there. And in fact, there are lots of gods. And it's not that they're in my head all the time. In fact, we could try to hide stuff from the God. You know, they're just kind of like powerful people. And then sort of as that progressed, yes. In fact, this is a separate discussion. We're definitely going to have another episode on the self. Mm-hmm. But one of the theories that I had heard about that was that if you could have, you know, very old-timey societies that have even religion, but that don't have the sense of self that we have. They just don't have that sense of self-reflection. And so that, you know, you could have religion without having this, but definitely one of the things that would give rise to the sense of self and our focus on ourselves that we have, you know, ourselves as the contents of my consciousness, the kind of thing we were talking about, you know, that Descartes would even have the approach he had in the first place, is because of this, you know, specific religious background where God is right there in our mind with us.
Right.
And, you know, so it actually matters if, you know, the notion of a conscience and us having to reflect on our own conscience, that's...
Right.
I think that's kind of later historically.
Yeah, and that's a good recapitulation of some of what is in the Genealogy of Morality as well. Our sense of what we think of as conscious self actually comes out of religion because it's a way to say, oh, there's a responsible, guilty party there. We are free and responsible for our actions. It's a way to make sense of the relationship between God and the individual. But I think we're probably going to agree to disagree about this, but it doesn't require the sort of Cartesian level of reflection. And this is Freud's explanation, which is that think of God as the punishing parent, or an extension of that.
Sure.
And that sort of is the origin. It's coeval with the rules and morality of society and the things to which we have to conform, and or with the punishments of our parents, and then internalized in the superego or yep. unconscious yep. and so on and so forth. But anyway, I think those are all very useful. Getting that context of the different things we could mean by meaning of life, it helps us with Camus here.
Well, that's a good hypothesis for why we might have this idea that there's a God out there that has a plan, and we each have a part to play in this plan, and that is our purpose. And so that's really where I see, you know, whatever the psychological and social reasons why that became a prominent mm-hmm. part of our culture, I think that's the sort of thing that we're, you know, that is yeah. so locked into us, is still this, just the idea of asking what the meaning of life is in the first place. Just, it doesn't even make sense, I think, apart from that kind of background framework.
Yeah, I think, though, one of the questions here is whether it's the result of a basic psychological need, which I think Camus is saying, and the cultural manifestations come from that, or whether it's just a random product of some cultural accident that wasn't really necessary. And I would fall on the side of saying, well, there's a basic psychological need, and then there are the cultural manifestations of that.
Mark, what you talk about the difference between, say, gods and kind of what's more like sort of religious ideas about, or religion, you know, this idea of
meaning coming
from religion, and as opposed to just the idea of there being gods, is that there's a very sort of basic connection where we know that according to most major religions, suicide is a sin, right? So you can probably draw the line and connect the dots between the meaning that's tied with this concept of a plan and your role in that plan, and then the kind of mandatory participation in that plan. Yep. So there's definitely a chain of reason that gets you from an idea of God and religion down to very, very specifically saying suicide is not okay, right? So however you want to tie those things up together, it's definitely there.
Right, and if you have this idea of morality, that all morality comes from God, all teleology, all purposefulness, which encompasses anything normative, any mm-hmm. any shoulds that come around have to come from religion, then yes, okay, once there's no God. So if you are an atheist, but you come out of a very theistic tradition, and so that's really still controlling the way you think about things, then once you decide there is no God, then it's pretty natural to say, if there's no God, everything is permitted, right? Because that's where all morality was coming from in the first place. So one of the things, then, that would be permitted would be suicide, mm-hmm. As you're saying. And add to that the Buddhist conception, which I think many, many people beyond Buddhists would agree that, I mean, they just say life is inherently suffering, but you could just say that you're uncomfortable more often than you're not. Right? Particularly at most points in history. Yes, we're all sitting here very comfortable, but throughout most of history, particularly, the times of pleasure were few and far between compared to, you know, the amount of time you have to break your back. And even most of us today might reflect on our jobs and agree with that statement.
Right.
So, that would make life more trouble than it's worth. If there's going to be more pain than pleasure on the whole, then it would seem to just make sense to kill yourself.
I think at one point he talks, though, about the sort of common explanations for suicide, like, oh, they had cancer and they were suffering too much. I think he thinks those are sort of rationalizations in the scheme of things, because a lot of people will suffer tremendously and cling to life.
Right. Well, if they find meaning in their suffering, right?
Right.
You could suffer as much as you want, but if you can have a story in which this is somehow necessary, whether it's because this is God's will and I'm doing my role in that, or I don't know how many right. people would really accept that when it comes down to it. You know, they have some other reason to keep pushing on, or just hope.
Right.
Right? That's another
sure.
thing, that, you know, the realization that we're all going to die is essentially the death of hope, that you might have hope for mm-hmm. a little more time, but, you know, come on, is a little more time going to make that much difference? This is at least where it seems like, I don't know, what do you think about Camus' point about eventual death, right? So we're eventually going to die, so therefore that's, at least on the face of it, grounds for saying everything that I'm striving toward now is ridiculous. There's an obvious response mm-hmm. to that, you know, I just asked my 8-year-old son that when I was walking around, and like, well, I'm not going to die for a while, right? I mean, I'm going to get payback on what I'm doing before that.
See, I remember trying, when I was teaching this, at University of Texas, it was impossible for me to convey the dilemma to my students, because this is how postmodern, modern we are. They said, well, I don't, you know, it just doesn't make any sense, the idea that, you know, I get meaning out of the daily things I do, by which they meant pleasure. The concept of existential angst just didn't register with them.
It doesn't have to be pleasure. It could be, you know, the striving, the goals
mastery
I have set for myself and how well I'm doing
yeah,
on those goals.
The sense of mastery, right. And I think that's that's an important distinction, because we're talking about the fundamental motivation here for what we do. And we could say, well, bodily pleasure, but that doesn't take it into account a higher order pleasure and one's own mastery of things. Or Nietzsche has a great quote to the effect that, because he's countering English utilitarians, is that it's not that we're all driven by pleasure, just the Englishman is. Which is to say, his theory is that the will of power, in fact, is more fundamental, and then this Epicurean idea that pleasure is motivating everything isn't a particularly English idea, because of their leisure and sitting around drinking tea and so on and so forth. So the will to power, which has something, you know, obviously to do with mastery, but if we say that that will to power itself is a manifestation of, let's say, this need for meaning, or this need for, you know, we might go farther and say that really, whether we acknowledge it or not, there is this fundamental motivation towards meaning, in the sense, again, of possibly my life having some significance to some absolute other.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of your son, you know, it may be the case that he's not in touch, for instance, with his own yearning for meaning. Do you know what I'm saying? He can report that, well,
I think it was that I was giving some leading questions. That's the way it was going on, but
because, all right, let's think about, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I remember having these feelings about being worried as a little kid, or even now sometimes, you know, it's thinking this is all so meaningless and I'm just going to be dead one day and what's the point? But it's really, it is hard to articulate that feeling, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, I don't, that was certainly wasn't the kind of kid that I was.
Well, I'm not saying I was obsessed with that.
I'm not implying that you were. I'm just saying that, you know, as a child, this does not strike me as, I would say that the impulse to find meaning definitely feels like it's something that's there, you know, from the beginning. But the realization that life is absurd seems to me that it's something that only comes with experience and time. And it's probably fair to point out that, you know, when Camus was writing this, he was still very much sort of haunted by the events of the, you know, first half of the 20th century. And I think there were lots of people that were sort of shaken by the Second World War and the Holocaust and, you know, the Cold War that followed, and, you know, sort of asking themselves, how could this possibly, well, let's put it this way. There were a lot of people that truly believed that God had died, right? That we'd sort of lost the concept of God. And then there was a strong, strong, strong need to find some kind of meaning after God and to justify or explain or find some way to reconcile themselves with the events that occurred. And so, you know, in that light, I think we have to take this seriously, that there probably were a lot of people who lost everything during the war or were looking at that and just saying, I can't live in a world that's like this, that allows this to happen, where there's this complete senselessness and meaningless and violence and so on. And, you know, in some sense, I think we should probably, as much as I struggled with the reading and all the various things that are problematic about it, we should at least commend Camus for trying to take a stand, you know, telling people we may have learned something very critical in the 20th century that, you know, for thousands of years we took for granted. Namely, that there really isn't any meaning, but we have to overcome these thousands of years and this tradition and this history and our attachment to God and all these sorts of things to own up to it and say it doesn't stop the need to perpetuate the species and to continue to create art and think through these things and participate with others and that sort of thing. So at the root of it, I can commend him for saying suicide is not the right response to the fact that God is dead.
Now, we have our own parallel to that, you know, that these people lived through World War II where so many people are dying that, you know, you start to question the value of human life. We had the TV writer strike just recently.
That. That was fucking horrible. I'll never forget that. Trauma. He was in the French Resistance, by the way.
Yes.
And by the way, I have a correction. It wasn't a motorcycle accident. It was an automobile accident. So.
Okay.
And,
son of a bitch.
But, you know, maybe he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, you know, so that theory still.
Through the magic of Google, we know that the Shakespeare quote is from Macbeth. So.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
I was just about to say Macbeth before I.
Well, actually, though,
just kidding.
to make a serious point where Mark refuses to.
Can I make one more joke first? Yeah. Was it maybe he died like in Grindhouse? If you see that, where the professional stunt woman like straps herself to the front of the car and like holding on by a belt just for fun? Is that how he died?
I did
Wait,
not
did
see
she
that
die?
Movie.
No, she did not die. But that was he being risky? Like the joke didn't work. Never mind.
I'm far too literal minded for these
saw
jokes.
Grindhouse, might
that was a horrible movie, by the way. But anyway, Seth.
So, well, no, I think there have been plenty of events in the last, say, 20 or 30 years that we could point to that we could use sort of in the same context or as a premise for asking ourselves these questions, you know. And actually, I was just talking to my parents this today, and we were just talking about, I don't know, something about the internet or social networking or something. And I was just talking about how radically things have changed in our lifetimes, remembering a time when you had to dial a wheel to make a phone call. And then, you know, before the internet, right? I mean, what did we do before cell phones? And how my niece has a cell phone at 13 and is, you know, Twittering and Facebooking and MySpacing and all that kind of stuff, right? But a lot of people, I think, could look at the political situation in the world today as destabilized as it feels like it is. And, you know, even since 9/11 or the first Gulf War, and you see that sort of the rise of China and the way that the Chinese are sort of imposing their will on the rest of the world through some of the less developed nations and terrorism and these nation states in the Middle East and kind of now North Korea threatening a nuclear war. There's plenty of reasons, plenty of things that you could use as an excuse to ask yourself, like, what the hell is going on? And, you know, does it make sense to raise a kid in this kind of world and do all these other sorts of things? So I think the premises are there that you could have this discussion. But I think at the same time, we've kind of established, okay, we have a craving for meaning. We live in this kind of postmodern world where, you know, God is dead, so you have to find it someplace else. Camus' first response was that there is no meaning, you know, no God, no meaning. Maybe there's another answer. You know, maybe there's you look in the face of the other. We can pull a little philosophical twist where all the meaning in life is in your relationships with others or in the other person. I don't know. But I mean, that's the fundamental question. This gets back to this point where I'm still trying to make sense of this idea that when I come to the point where I realize that life has no meaning, you know, is my first thought that suicide is the appropriate response? And for me, the answer is no. But I grant that, you know, we live in very different times and things are quite a bit different than they were. And again, it's good that he's arguing against that. By the way, I just want to say this one thing about the part, Wes, where he says there's many causes of suicide, but what sets off the crisis is almost unverifiable, he says. Mm-hmm. And he said something that I thought was really, it's kind of a tossaway comment, but it was really poignant for me.
I know, yeah.
He says, you know, it could be a trauma that was like years old, but maybe that day that this person decides to commit suicide, they got brushed off by a friend of theirs.
Yeah.
And I just thought about that, and I was like, you know, just imagine.
I thought that was great, yeah.
You know, somebody who's got a deep down buried trauma, and just they call you one day, and you're just too busy to talk to them, you know, and you're just like, hey, can I call you back? I'm just too busy. But they really needed to hear you and feel needed and loved and whatever. And so that's the thing that kind of triggers it. And I was asking myself, I was like, you know, is that in itself kind of a moral imperative, you know, him sort of suggesting that really you really have to be present for other people because you really never know what's going on underneath. You know, you never know who's potentially in this position where, you know, they could be set off down this terrible path or take these terrible actions. If maybe that day you just pick up the phone and like, hey man, what's going on? It's all good. And they just need that 5 minutes to kind of pour themselves out to you. I don't know. I thought that was very, very nice. I wish the rest of the essay made me feel the same way.
But isn't it the people that you usually feel like, if I don't take this phone call, this person is going to kill themselves? Like the person that has already made 14 of those phone calls to you in the past couple months. And you're like, God fucking, like, I gotta cut it off somewhere. I mean, I have a life. Come on.
No, that may be. You know, there's a fine line between being a good friend and referring somebody to a therapist, I guess.
Or just telling him to do it. Just do it.
Aw.
Sometimes maybe that's the medicine. So, yeah, do it. Sorry.
Join their
maybe they need the validation of having someone say, yeah, you know, actually that does make sense. I'm sorry.
Forever I shall be a stranger to myself.
Yes.
So there were some other ways of recognizing the absurd we haven't covered yet.
Yeah.
For instance, recognizing how little you are in relation to the universe, right? That seems to be the most common one. Surely my life can't matter, given that I'm on one world among many.
Yeah, that I haven't
giant
experienced.
Cosmos. Looking up at the vast sky.
Yeah.
Which, of course, then the obvious response to that is, well, screw that. I don't care about the vast sky. It's my life.
The thing, though, is I think, so Camus gives examples, too, of philosophers who think they've sort of mapped out this existential position, you know, so say, for instance, Kierkegaard, where you recognize the absurdity of things, but then the solution is to take the leap of faith. So again, so for Camus, that's a cop-out, right? You have to recognize the absurd and then stick with it, but sticking with it may not be as easy as one thinks, and you may be copping out without knowing it. You may be, let's say, smuggling the absolute into your little world, even while you say, oh, I don't give a shit, you know, who cares, there is no God, I'm an atheist, this, that. You may be covertly sneaking it in. So that, to me, is an interesting point.
Well, I wonder if he isn't guilty of that
exactly
himself, that he exactly talks about, once you recognize the absurd and you can fix on it, then happiness can come out
exactly
of that. And in fact, it's, you know, true happiness and true living, you know, is really only possible when you recognize the absurd. Well, how is that not just ignoring it? How do you really know? Like, if you're just, if the solution, which I've heard to this existentialist talk, okay, we realize that there's no God-given meaning. Meaning is not in the world itself. The vast cosmos doesn't care about me. So the solution is to just, you know, recognize my own responsibility for creating meaning, create projects for myself, throw myself into things, don't let society just tell me what to do. You know, well, how is that not just copping out and ignoring the absurd anyway?
Exactly.
Right? Getting excited about the new Star Trek movie again.
That, to me, was one of the most interesting parts of this essay, since he's accusing others of this, others who think they have sort of recognized the absurd. Well, we have to ask, has Camus really come to terms with it, or is it sort of inevitable? Is it the human condition that, let's say, the absolute is snuck back in? What is he trying to do by giving us this formula for being authentic human beings, let's say? Shouldn't he have given up on authenticity? Isn't he still implying that meaning is
right
necessary, or we might as well commit suicide? That at the very least, we must be authentic by saying, well, our authenticity lies in recognizing the absurd. Doesn't that become the meaning? And isn't that the cop-out and the way to avoid suicide? So I'm not sure what the answer to that question is, but I find interesting.
Part of it is just kind of like relativist morality, that he's saying that, you know, morality is not written in the world in the same way that meaningfulness is not written in the world. It's something that we come up with. And then he follows up by saying only the people that recognize the absurd are going to have sort of a respectable ethic. And, you know, he has some definite, you know, ethical talk. Well, is he allowed to do that? I mean, as a relativist, you can just say, okay, so he's talking from his point of view.
I don't think he's a relativist, though. I think he's a skeptic, which is a different thing. Do you know what I mean by that?
No.
Yeah.
He himself calls himself a skeptic. And you see this from the very beginning of the essay. He actually quotes Aristotle's argument for the law of contradiction, which is an anti-relativist argument. Let me find that, just because I think it is actually important. The consequence of rejecting the law of contradiction is that you're forced to admit an infinite number of true or false judgments. In other words, you can't, and this is essential to his argument, because he argues in the part where he's arguing against certain philosophies, he's arguing against relativism, because you can't get rid of reason. The point is not to eliminate this distinction between truth
sure
and falsity. So the relativist
yep
believes there is no distinction between truth and falsity. The skeptic believes there is a difference, yet we can never, it's just that we can never know the truth. And those are crucial differences, because to say, to eliminate that distinction between truth and falsity, that's just like the leap of faith, that's just a cop-out. To say, oh, there is no such thing as reason, is just one form of the cop-out. To be the skeptic says,
sure. Yep.
You know, you don't collapse those poles. You say, yes, the reason has its utility, and there is such a thing as a truth, but I can never know it, and so you keep that tension.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's pretty consistent about that when it comes to epistemological matters. So one of the other ways that we recognize the absurd is by recognizing the limits of human reason in the way Kant that talked about mm-hmm. it. The fact that, yeah, we can use our reason to analyze, you know, experiences to come up with science, but we end up, you know, being a skeptic about the big things. We can't use reason to give us a fully mapped out vision of the universe like Aristotle had, or you know, anything else that any religious based philosopher, you know, pre-existentialist might want. I mean, that all applies to, you know, what can we know about the universe? That there's something fundamentally unknowable and foreign about things in themselves, about the world, as counter to our innate desire, just like we have a desire for meaning, we have a desire for understanding.
Yeah.
Right. So I think, you know, he's pretty consistent about that when it comes to the epistemological matters. But when it comes to the moral matters, so I have another quote here. He's talking about the coming into contact, recognizing absurdity and not copping out in any way, not committing suicide, for instance. He says that revolt, you know, the revolt against the unknowable universe, it gives life its value. Spread out over the whole length of a life, it restores its majesty to that life. To a man devoid of blinders, there's no finer sight than that of the intelligence at grips with a reality that transcends it. The sight of human pride is unequaled. That sounds like something that he thinks we all will buy in terms of a moral prescription. Does that violate his his skepticism?
I'm not sure.
Can I be skeptical about and say, no, I think if you... Yeah, okay, I recognize the absurd, but I recognize that this is an inhospitable place to live. I want to, as Camus puts it, I want to be cured of this illness. I don't want to maintain the illness, as he recommends. That's freaking crazy talk. I want to be, you know, securely give myself some meaning. You know, so I set up a bunch of goals. I set up my family. I want to work for my legacy. I want to work for my kids and their kids. And I don't think that's absurd at all then. I've set that up. You know, I don't want to be face-to-face with this. Why does that make me... So I'm not revolting anymore. I've accepted, I'm reconciled to the inhuman universe, and I've set up my own little enclave of purposes and people I care about, and I think that's the way to go, not this standing on the brink at all times. No, get to the brink and then back the hell off of the brink, because the brink sucks. Like, so why am I a wuss, according to Camus? Why is there no finer sight than intelligence at grips with a reality that transcends it?
Which sounds very much like the classical philosophical position. You know, Plato, Aristotle, arguably they're skeptics, and they also say the best thing in life is to live the contemplative life. You know you're never going to get to the truth, but you embrace the journey, and you embrace that tension, and you engage in that gripping with the reality that transcends it. You know, it's interesting here because this talk, he did his PhD thesis on Plotinus, which is that mystical union, that Neoplatonic idea of being one with the beyond. And that's what this language here sounds like. Intelligence at grips with a reality that transcends it. As someone who thinks of himself as a skeptic, I think probably this is why I enjoyed the reading so much. It's sort of right up my alley as far as my little idea of what the meaning of life is, which is this sort of being in that state of tension and seeking.
Can I bring up a textual point here? I was asking myself if he just traded the notion of God for like a notion of the absurd. As we've seen from Descartes and others, all you're really looking for is that lever. You know, you really just need that one place to start, and is that his starting point? Well, he makes a comment towards the end. He says, belief in the meaning of life always implies a scale of values, a choice, or preferences. But belief in the absurd teaches the contrary. And he goes on further to explain, and he says, really the question is, can you live without appeal?
That's great, yeah.
And what I think he means by that is, if you live your life in such a way that you believe there's meaning in life, you have something to appeal to. Well, why did you do this? Why is that good? Why is that just? Why should I be doing this? Well, God said so. Well, I have this moral philosophy that it's born out of the state of nature. You know, oh, I have this, I have that. And what he's saying is that the belief in the notion of the absurd, or recognition of the absurdity of life or what have you, is really saying, I don't have any reason for doing this or saying this, other than, and he goes on to say, I can't talk about best living. I can only talk about most, what he says, most living.
Yeah.
And what he basically is saying is that all I can appeal to is my share of human experience, that your conduct and your sense of values have no meaning or utility except through the quantity and variety that you've been in a position to accumulate. So if you buy into this concept of absurdity and the absurd life, the imperative is that you have to go and just accumulate as much experience as you possibly can, as much life as you possibly can, and build your value set or whatever out of that.
Does it allow him to escape? Does he escape the accusation of sneaking in the meaning, let's say?
No, I don't think he does. It's an interesting and in some ways kind of an elegant solution to the problem.
It is, yeah.
But he's still starting...
Quantity, not quality.
Yeah.
I had a hard time with that part. And is it just that you can't ask why to that? That's just something that is part of our sensibility. This is at least how Nietzsche would answer it. That this is something that's part of our sensibility, and to deny that is to deny ourselves, is to deny one part of the equation, right? Us coming at the world with a set of expectations and desires and whatever. And we can't just... We have to be skeptical about those things. You know, maybe they're not leading us in the right direction, but that's what we got. That's the equipment that we're born with. So if we just say, screw all that, you know, and go with nihilism, then we're denying one half of the absurd equation. If we say, screw all that because God has a replacement, we're still denying, you know, one half of the equation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You reminded us of the recognition of the need for meaning on the one hand, and the contradiction between that and the absurd on the other. You can't give either one of them up. And that's this really is sort of a neo-Nietzschean? It's a elaboration on the Nietzsche's solution to nihilism, which is the sort of philosopher, artist, and the gay science. So the two poles there are gay and science, or the Dionysian and the Apollonian.
That is joyful and wisdom.
Yeah. So that you're sort of the Dionysian, drink wine and lose yourself, and that sort of, which is the sort of nihilistic hedonism, and then the Apollonian, which is the more sober and ascetic and scientific. Nietzsche's Übermensch is sort of the philosopher-artist combination of those two things.
So, right, Kant was the first one who sort of recognized the limits of, you know, at least popularly recognized as such, as recognizing the limits of human reason. So we have the realm that reason can talk about, human reason, so the sciences, but then we have the things in themselves. If we have this notion of the absurd or of meaninglessness or something, you know, it's easy to then give a character to that, and like Seth was saying, the absurd becomes a substitute for God or something like that. And so that's, Camus is walking a very fine line to create this, even by putting the capital A on absurd and creating this thing outside of our possible understanding and experience, and not somehow be violating his prescription to keep the tension alive. Like, because it seems like hard to be a good, you know, recognizer of this absurd and not be reconciled to it.
Right. To wear the leather jacket and the beret and say, yeah, I'm in touch with the absurd.
How are you really supposed to do this and remain unreconciled?
There's an anxiety produced by our deepest desires, which we can escape by just sort of collapsing that desire and
not
living sort
anymore,
of
yep.
in our immediate pleasures, and doing things which are less important to us but still pleasurable. And does that make sense? That's sort of something I think about a lot.
I certainly sympathize with that in terms of, like, the music thing, that I you know, want to keep doing music and doing things in a professional enough way. I could hit it big. A record company could discover how awesome my album that just came out is. At the same time, I'm not going to, like, suffer in the way that, you know, you really would if you're going to give your all to it. I'm not going to desert my family and travel around the country for no money. Like it's, but there's a tension there. It's you want to do something seriously enough that you can get into it, but you want to keep it in perspective so that you're not, doesn't consume you. So you're not, thinking that this, so I don't know if that, am I living according to Camus' recommendation there, or am I, by sort of being a little safe about it, is that wussing out in a way? I don't know if he really gives guidance about this or not.
I don't think so. And I don't think he does give guidance.
His primary concern in this essay is to basically argue against killing yourself. He doesn't really have a lot to go on as far as telling you kind of proscriptively what to do once you don't kill yourself, right? That's why that last bit is kind of an add-on. And there's a point at which he says something about, this between the certainty I have of my existence and the content I try to give to that, the gap will never be filled. Even after he thinks he's solved the problem of what to do when you recognize this fact and recognize absurdity, he's still no closer to filling that gap. Even if you buy everything he says, where it's like, okay, life's absurd, I have no hope, I'm not in despair, I just have no hope of reconciling this with my craving for meaning, I'm going to constantly...
He's in despair in quotation marks.
Yeah.
The ontological notion of despair, but that's not actually being said.
Yeah, no. It's Angst vor dem Tod, right? Basically, all I've done is managed to convince myself not to commit suicide. Now, what I do from here on out, that's, I guess, entirely up to me. If you buy all this, you're ultimately thrown back on yourself. Recognizing the absurd and dealing with this is actually, in a kind of weird way, a complete rejection of the idea that there is anything other or outside yourself to which you can appeal, if we use his language. Mm-hmm. So you're now 100% totally reliant on yourself. Ultimately, you're left to your own devices, but this absolute and total isolation from anything outside yourself that could give you the meaning to live is in itself no reason for not continuing to live. Discuss, right? Like, I mean, that's basically it. It's like, here you go. And maybe he has other essays where he fills that out a little bit more, but that's kind of how what
is
we're left
giving
with.
Just a generic, like, seize the day? Is that...
I don't even think it's that positive.
Old time...
I don't think it's that positive. I don't think it's seize the day. It's really, like, it's really kind of depressing, actually. It's, to me, anyway.
I don't think it's supposed to be. At least this is the Robert Solomon interpretation of existentialism as a whole, that, again, just because there's no meaning built into the world, that means we generate our own meaning, and so that comes down to kind of a seize-the-day thing, with a strong emphasis on there are no excuses for not doing so. Now, that might be pulling more so from other existentialists like Sartre than Camus in particular, I'm not sure.
See, I think there's another alternative, too, which is just to say there's something about the mystery itself. I mean, what we might call the absurd, I think he talks about breaking, as a scientist, for instance, you might think you're going to get to the bottom of things, but when getting to the bottom of things means precisely getting to something irrational, because for something to be scientifically explicable and rational means that you can keep dividing it, and you can cut the atom down to the electron and nucleus, and then you can get down to quarks. And on the one, there are two possibilities here: either you keep subdividing to get down to the more primitive explanations of things, or it stops. And if you stop, then let's say you found the ultimate subatomic particle, and it's no longer divisible. Well, then that thing is itself irrational. There is no explanation of its properties. Let's say what I'm trying to say here is that you can do the same thing with time in the beginning of the world, the fundamental mystery of causality with the universe, because you might think you have to get to some uncaused cause, or that those causes go on infinitely. But I think so that there's a something fundamentally mysterious and irrational there, and I think my position personally is that mystery itself is a kind of religious awe. But I think So while I'm a skeptic and I don't think you can get at the truth, there is some sort of probably quasi-religious element to this, this, let's say, worship of the mystery, which I think skepticism can be. I'm not sure. I think Camus is a skeptic because he's advocating that tension, but I'm not sure.
That's cheating in exactly the way I was talking about,
yeah.
What I was getting at with that whole talking about Kant and folks like that. Yeah. Because he talks about, we haven't mentioned his analysis of Husserl yet, another guy that we have not talked about and probably eventually will. Just that we did talk about phenomenology a little bit, which was this idea that following Kant's idea that, oh, there's the world of appearances that we can say sensible things about, and there's the world in itself that we can't say sensible things about.
Right.
Well, Husserl is a guy that said, well, let's make a science of examining our own experience.
Right.
That we'll just, we'll try say, well, we won't put any theories behind it. We won't be like those old-time empiricists who, you know, were talking about the which parts of perception are in our minds and which part are, you know, out in the world or something, because, you know, there's really no basis for that. That's not in our experience.
Right.
If we want to be good empiricists, really
just
only pay attention
facts.
To our... Yeah, exactly. Give just the facts. And he criticizes... So that's a guy who's really trying not to cheat, not to reach into the world of essences in the
fails.
World of... Yeah, because... And in fact, he uses words like essences.
Essence is his favorite word, yeah.
Yes, that he creates instead of a single god, a single mass of things behind it, he creates a multitude of things because he seems to say, like, for instance, he wants to draw conclusions beyond the immediate, right? The reason it's not just that every individual fact of perception is unrelated to other facts.
Right.
No, he wants to say there are commonalities in the way that I, you know, perceive one material object and another, you know, what I call a material object and another what I call a material object, or the way I perceive myself and the way you perceive yourself. And so he's able to get these essences, you know, the essence of material object, even though that doesn't mean what we thought it meant, you know, before Kant, you know, still it's creating these essences in a way that supposedly cheats.
Yeah.
Supposedly reaches beyond actual appearance. I mean, did you like that criticism?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's spot on.
I skipped that part.
This goes to, and I like the fact that you mentioned, so we're talking about this tension, and we talked about Kant. The very beginning, the preface to the Critique of Pure Reason, I'm going to quote it. Human reason in one sphere of its cognition is called upon to consider questions which it cannot decline as they are presented by its own nature, but which it cannot answer as they transcend every faculty of the mind. The idea is we are never going to get beyond having the question. We're not going to be able to get rid of that, even if we aren't going to be able to answer it. So, and I like the also Camus' quote about animals. You know, a cat, just because they can't ask the question, they have that very familiarity with the world, which we can't have. And the only reason we can't have that immediate familiarity is because we have the desire for the familiarity, because our consciousness has made it a question to us. So I love that paradox. But I think, again, the question, what those things imply, I think, to me, is that you always end up cheating. You'll never, I guess, it's what do we want to call cheating? If cheating is the fact
the
that we're never going to be able to get rid of the questions that we can't answer, then I think we're not going to be able to get beyond that. I think Camus maybe thinks we get beyond it by having a reflective approach to it, by having that tension, but then being aware of it. I'm not exactly sure. So I'm not, but I think with his criticism of Husserl and the same sort of criticism we might direct at Camus, is you could say, well, there's just no escape. And the recognition that there is no escape really is the best you can do. I don't know.
Yeah,
that seems
to fulfill the prescription to have an examined life, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Sure.
You don't have to be poised there examining it all the time, right? He's running with the ball that Socrates gave us in the very, you know, the reading we did for the first podcast of The Unexamined Life is Not Worth Living. Well, when you've examined your life,
yeah,
you will find the absurd. And is that worth living? You know, and I actually thought that it was kind of funny how he mentioned Plato specifically and criticizes Plato's dictum of, you know thyself, which is another way to say, you know, have an examined life. That he said that's actually another way that if you delve far enough into yourself, you begin to see that you yourself are fundamentally unknowable in the same way that the universe is.
Yeah.
So you can't know yourself, and telling you to do that is vague and unhelpful in the same way that, you know, a moral prescription, if somebody says, what's your morality? And you say, be virtuous.
But I think Plato obviously knows you can't fully know yourself. Plato, you know, one point Plato calls philosophy dying, right? Because you don't really you don't really succeed until you're dead, or become a cat, I think, in Camus' terms. So, a cat, becoming a cat is a great way of knowing yourself, I think. But it's a question of, do you keep trying to know yourself even though you know that it's futile? Do you become Sisyphus in that sense? I like the idea that you do. You sort of embrace an inquiry to which you know there's no end and there's no way to answer these questions. I'm not sure if Camus thinks that being Sisyphus and rolling the rock up the hill only to have it fall back down to the base every time is, if he's thinking of philosophy exactly there, or if he thinks it's worthwhile to keep asking these questions. I'm not sure.
Well, you've given us a segue into that second reading, which is essentially an illustration of this first one, or you could say that, you know, that's the primary thing, since most people are asked to read in intro philosophy classes or whatever. If they do any Camus, they read the 6-page version instead of this whole mass that we did on Absurdity and Suicide. It's called The Myth of Sisyphus, and so you've given the picture, right? This is an old Greek myth. What he wants to use is as an illustration for kind of the absurdity of life. So that really all the stuff, I think you could say to any human endeavor, but certainly people who have regular jobs that they have to do to, you know, keep food on the table and keep going can identify with this idea that, wow, it seems, you know, I have this routine and it just seems meaningless. You know, what am I supposed to do about that? And so he's imagining an even more extreme, you know, most extreme possible situation, most extreme situation perhaps ever envisioned of this kind of useless, futile behavior. And he wants to say, what is that's kind of like us, that because of death, because of the absurd, that's kind of like us, whatever we choose to do, with doing philosophy, doing our regular work, whatever. So what is the appropriate response to that? How does the absurd man react to that? Mm-hmm. And what are his answers?
Actually, what I remember from it is just where he was talking about, he says it's the part that interests him is what Sisyphus is thinking as he walks back down the hill.
Yep. So when he's actually reflective about it, as opposed to just trying to do it. So that's kind of like the moment that we're recognizing the absurd.
Right.
I think at some point he says he imagines that there might even be joy, like a kind of a, you can imagine Sisyphus walking back down with a wry smile on his face. Like, you think you've got the best of me, but yeah. I'm owning it, as we would say nowadays.
Happiness and the absurd are two sons of the same earth. And then that's the previous paragraph. And then the beginning of the next is Sisyphus' silent joy is contained therein. His rock is his thing. Interesting.
Yeah, so he gives two answers in there. That one of them is that one, which is, well, you know, I do all this work, but like if I identify with it, if I feel free while I'm doing it, then that's okay. That's a good. So it almost doesn't matter how shitty your situation is, that you can adjust to it and sort of feel free within it, and that will give you. That's what freedom is. That freedom is not this absolute freedom from someone influencing you or even from someone, you know, putting tasks before you, or freedom from earthly responsibility. It's identifying with whatever it is you happen to be doing. It's feeling
yes,
free. It's
I
a
wanted
real
to
feeling.
Write that paper. I wanted to roll the rock up the hill over and over.
But the second answer he gives is scorn. That as long as he can do it with this ironic, scornful attitude, like, screw you, gods. As long as you can, you know, give him the finger while he's doing it, then he can feel better about it.
Interesting.
So that you can transcend your situation. So I don't know if those two things contradict. He's saying, you know, on the one hand, throw yourself into it, make it your thing. On the second, you have to rise above it in some way. You have to recognize the transcendence of you over and above this situation that you're in. So those are probably not a contradiction, because obviously, you know, we all do that from moment to moment. That maybe that's exactly this kind of thing. So going back to the analogy of if you're, you know, want to get into music or dance or whatever, yeah, okay, while you're doing it, really take it seriously so it's, you know, as fulfilling an experience as possible, but then also keep it in perspective, you know, kind of realize that it's a game.
Well, and I think
in some way, don't kill yourself if you fail at it then.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think I remember at University of Texas, and when I was younger, and I think this is typical when, you know, the idea of becoming a professor of philosophy was so important to me and it was my beyond, it was my, you know, that I trembled before it, and I couldn't just struggle with the, I couldn't focus on, let's say, rolling the rock, and I really was thinking, and I kept thinking about, you know, whether I was going to get the rock to the top of the hill. If I were older, I would have known that even if I had become a philosophy professor, I still wouldn't have gotten the rock to the top of the hill. And that I really don't, that no one really wants that, because it's, you know, that's sort of the end of desire, and you focus on the struggle. So then, you know, it's like doing a philosophy podcast or continuing to read philosophy and discuss it. Those things are, as part of the struggle, are inherently satisfying, and you've sort of given up on that beyond. You've given up on that ultimate, oh yes, I'm going to be the this great success, or in your case,
change,
you know, the famous
become
musician.
Historically significant. Yeah.
Those are less relevant, in the same way that, let's say, if you're, you know, you might have given up on God as not, you might have given up on God as something that's relevant. You've negated the gods, to use his term, by focusing on the rolling of the stone.
I guess I remain unreconciled, because I'm still kind of pissed off that I'm not a rock star. You know, I haven't grown out of that.
If you become a rock star, man, you'd be dead by now. First of all, you'd have coked out and crashed. And no, I'm just kidding. I'm trying to say a lot of people are destroyed by that kind of success.
Right. I guess maybe what has changed, I'm not even entirely sure if this is relevant, but I just found myself thinking about this today, is I think I had more of a belief when I was younger in genius in various forms.
Yeah.
And maybe genius is not the best word in all cases, but it's just that, and this is part of our desire for understanding in the way Camus is talking about it, just to bring Camus' name back in for a second, is to believe in a pantheon, an understandable set of things. So whatever area it is, like, so if you're studying philosophy, you know, it's comforting to think that there's a canon of genius philosophers. And as long as you study this canon,
you will get into it.
And, right, you will know what's going on. Whereas I think most of the guys we've read, like, in fact, some of my resentment against Descartes or Hobbes or some of these guys
we're
reading.
They're not the gods you thought they were.
Well, it's that I don't discount as much as I thought. Like, people tend to really deify these original works, whereas I think the people writing about the original works are probably, a lot of them are just as smart as the people that were originally
totally
writing it.
Disagree.
And in fact, they've
totally
had...
Totally disagree.
And in fact, okay, just let me continue. I mean, obviously, you're going to find a lot of crap in secondary literature and things, but I just don't think that the kind of genius, or what makes us retroactively label someone historically as a genius, you know, I think there's a lot of chance and bullshit that goes into that. I think that they're, you know, usually... I think that you can only really judge genius in your current age. So... You know, music is the thing I always return to. So there are, you know, certain, you know, it's hard for me to think of, okay, maybe is Radiohead a current genius group? Well, they do a little more and a little different synthesis of a lot of shit that's already around. They're very good craftsmen at what they do. And I think that that is very typical. So, like, it's harder for us to see, like, the Beatles. The Beatles seem obvious genius. That's because we were not listening to a lot of music when that came out. Like, they definitely were very, very... You know, good at what they did and good at synthesizing these things. But
I'm not
a lot
sure
of, you know,
I can
what
take
seems
this blasphemy,
so...
man. The Beatles, that's where I draw the line.
A lot of what a lot of what makes us, you know, label this sort of so innovative was synthesizing things that came before, that they brought in some pre-rock and roll stuff, that they brought in a
trumpets.
Few different kinds of instruments. Exactly. It's but sort of if you then compare that to, like, the amount of technical facility and knowledge that, you know, even the average music professor has, or look at some of the old, you know, Count Basie or one of these guys that can actually, like, arrange things for a full orchestra. Like, there's, you know,
we're not talking
all,
about technical
anything.
Facility, though, in that case. We're talking about,
well, but,
soul
but almost,
and creativity.
Almost anything in rock and roll, you know, so I was a big fan of prog rock, you know, Yes, and Old Genesis, and King Crimson, and these guys, because compared to what the very, you know, simplistic stuff that was coming out that was also called rock at the same time, it seemed to be reaching new ground, new awesomeness. There's genius unfolding. When it's so obvious to me now that, like, a lot of times when they're reaching beyond what their rock contemporary is doing, they're just kind of doing a lame version of what fusion was doing, right? It's a matter of synthesizing. So much of what genius is to me is a matter of, synthesizing and maybe be able to put that next step. And it's really just a lot of basic competence, being able to say the right, to put the gestalt of the times or, what your forebearers have already presented before you in a particularly compelling way. So if you can do that, and then the culture can catch on to that so that it actually becomes widely known and becomes a cultural touch point, then retroactively you are called genius.
See, I think, Seth, do you want to disagree first, and then I'll disagree?
Mark is so much more passionate than me about a lot of these things that it's tough. In some ways, I believe the genius is about recognizing something and acting on it, particularly when you're the first or you have these radical ideas and you find a way to bring them into being, whether it's writing a book or synthesizing music and creating a new genre of music or whatever. The fact of the matter is, you're the one that did it. And there's a genius not just in the act of doing it, but in presenting it, in pitching it, and being recognized for it, in promoting it, and carrying it to the world, and those sorts of things. And so there's a combination of sort of the inspiration or the thought or the capability or the talent or whatever, plus the production and manufacture of that talent. And pisses me off, frankly, to no end when somebody, I heard it once say that like every fifth grader now knows more about mathematics than Newton knew in his lifetime or something along those lines, right? The implication being that, march of time, march of science. It's a quaint curiosity. And it's like, well, look, he invented calculus, right? Or he was one of the two people that invented calculus. Like, no math professor who's teaching this stuff to college kids or writing books about theories or whatever comes even close to that level of what I would call genius. Like to be somebody who can do that, even if nowadays we teach it in school and every fifth grader now surpasses his knowledge, not every fifth grader is a genius of that caliber and is ever, going to generate anything like that. And that's, that's the part that gets me. Now, that being said, I was just going to say the piece about production. I just finished reading Malcolm Gladwell's new book. It's called
Blink.
Blink is his previous one.
Yeah, that's the last one.
Yeah, this one is called Outliers. One of the things that's interesting.
Oh yeah, I've heard of this.
I love that guy. I really love his work. Basically, the concept of outliers, he's examining this very thing, genius, success, right? And this idea that if you're a smart kid and you work hard, you can be successful. And he kind of puts the lie to that and says you have to be a smart kid, you have to work hard, but you also have to have a lot of things just kind of fall into your lap in the right way and kind of then take advantage of those opportunities. But the reason I bring this up, Mark, particularly relevant to your discussion, is that he talks about the Rolling Stones. I think it's the Rolling Stones. Yeah. You were talking about the Beatles, and now I'm confused, but I'm pretty sure. Basically,
I would count the Rolling Stones as genius, too.
Yeah. So, but his...
Well, and I know they're very astute in terms of business.
But his point about it is that there were lots of bands that were kind of around at that time, and they were not particularly good when they were playing in England. But they got booked on some brothel circuit in Germany.
Oh no, that's the Beatles.
Is it the Beatles? Okay, I'm confused. Yeah. I'm getting confused. But basically, they went and they would play for 12 hours a day, and they had to play and keep coming up with new songs. And they kind of honed their craft by being forced into this thing. And it's all part of this discussion he has about there's a magic number of 10,000 hours worth of doing something, and you become kind of a master craftsman at it.
And so, okay, I have heard about this.
So his kind of point is that it's not that they were any smarter or better than – clearly they are. They are very smart. They are very talented musicians. But they also were put in this circumstance where they were forced to hone their craft. I'm not sure that I see a lot of people honing their craft in that way or being that opportunistic and having that kind of thing, and certainly not in the philosophical arena where nowadays there is no – there's no kind of environment where people are encouraged to go and do that kind of, hey, why don't you go radically think through all these things? It's more like you hone your craft by commenting on other people's work. And it's only when you get to a certain point of security that you can start sort of really, 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 honing your craft, if you will.
And you And you also, you know, you might think of it as sort of a chemical reaction. Yes, you're drawing on Chuck Berry, let's say, and typical, you know, 1-4-5 rock songs like the Beatles. But you, and then, you know, once they put in the trumpets and their other little production elements, I mean, despite the fact that it's that you're drawing on inspiration from everyone who comes before, and obviously you have to, because you wouldn't even have a genre, you know,
right,
and you wouldn't have an instrument.
Nonsense.
But you might think that this is something new. This is sort of oxygen and hydrogen don't just give you little oxygen hydrogen combinations. They become water. I think there is something to the idea of genius, even though I know what you're saying, Mark, in the sense that I worshipped it so much, and it was so awe-inspiring to me that it filled me with some anxiety as well. If I had thought of it more in the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour sense, look, there's 99% perspiration, I think it would have been more helpful. But I think that's not to say that you give up on the idea of genius, or you give up on the idea of being a rock star or being a great success, because I think that is still part of that dyad of tension that Camus is talking about. Even if you know that you're focused on the struggle, you still need to have aspirations. You're not going to keep rolling the rock up. You may know when you become a rock star that you're going to need new challenges, let's say, or that you're not going to be able to stop, that you haven't rolled the rock up the hill, but you need those sort of way stations, you need those fantasies of having done that. And even if they're in some sense delusional, they're completely necessary.
Yeah, actually, you know, I've seen enough documentaries about being a rock star that to know how much it actually sucks.
Right.
It's more just like wanting to be such that, you know, like John Lennon was near the end of his life, or many, you know, other, where, you know, you could just make something in your house and you put it out there, and millions of people care.
Yeah. Well, there's, we get
like,
back to meaning again, in the sense
of cool,
of signifying to others, in the sense of being meaningful to others, and feeling authentic or actualized by that. I think that's extremely important. I used to think that was a very vulgar thing, right? Oh, I shouldn't want to be popular or be, you know, that's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing it because I love it. But I think that's essential. That's an essential motivation to be seen by other people and to give them pleasure, let's say, if you're on the stage. All those things are very important.
I guess, first of all, I do want to give one proviso. Like, I don't discount genius in terms of sheer mechanical brain power, like, you know, Mozart's ability to just transcribe something that he would just hear once, or especially in mathematical areas, which is so far beyond me in terms of just you know, I'm just still working on, like, doing two-digit by two-digit multiplication in my head, and, like...
Well, the genius there is being able to withstand the boredom.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding.
If you're a super genius, then it's not, you know, it comes so quickly to you, you don't have a chance to be bored. That's really... Maybe, I mean, that makes the perspiration that much easier. You have to do a little, you know, somewhat less perspiration than everybody else.
Makes having a girlfriend...
Your memory
makes
or
not
your
having a girlfriend that much easier.
But I wonder,
man, you guys are harsh.
You know, so
we're trying to understand the comedy.
I wonder.
Bit.
So I mentioned you know, Bob Solomon before, which is our recently departed University of Texas professor. He wrote like well over 100 books, you know, and was the go-to guy, and was so clear. Like, I was amazed listening to him in these. I don't know how much editing they did on these CDs, but it seemed like they were just more or less lectures that he was given. It sounded so well delivered, so off the cuff, so lacking in the verbal tics and repetitions that I noticed that we do so much that I have to edit out or attempt to of this podcast. That
10,000 hours and we'll get rid of that.
Yeah, you know, and this is a guy that just, you know, would write every day, would get up and write for a few hours. You know, and that's how he's got out this so many books. So why does he not get to be put in the pantheon along? And he even wrote at least this one book that I hope that we will talk about in some future episode, The Passions, you know, which was a very sort of his original piece of work. So it's not like he didn't produce anything original too. And then in his commentary on other things, you know, it's definitely had a very idiosyncratic way of casting these things. So like, his take on existentialism, you know, really emphasizing responsibility. You know, I really don't know how common that is among other commentators, but it certainly, you know, seems specific enough that if we lived in a different kind of day and age, then he would be put in the pantheon.
I think it can take a long time to get in the pantheon, though. I mean, that might still happen.
Or do you not think we just live in an era where scholarship is such that almost nobody's going to go in the pantheon, that you have to be Rorty level?
Well, although Rorty sucks, there's an element of...
that's why I brought him up, specifically, because I knew you didn't like him.
There's luck to that, and then I think Rorty his star will fall in the long run. But I think, you know, it's what Hume calls durable admiration. It's the test of time. I mean, of course, there's too many smart people in the world for everyone to, you know, receive that level of recognition, and they're probably...
I guess that's my point. The solution should be not, the pantheon can't hold all these people. Get rid of the idea of the damn pantheon. But that is something that we sort of insist on.
Well, you got to decide what to read, so there's always that problem, and there's got to be some guidance. Even if you rebel against that, it's a starting point. I mean, now you're more likely to be reading, Cosmopolitan anyway in the average university English class, so you don't really have to worry about the pantheon or the canon. Seth, can hear your silence.
Have we just wandered too far from the original topic?
Yeah, I think we have.
I think this is relevant to Camus, this talk of getting the boulder to the top, or at least the fantasy of that.
All right, so... did we talk enough about this scorn, this irony? You know, so we're stuck in this, and maybe it's okay to continue doing these meaningless things as long as we are kind of scornful and ironic about it, and we recognize that I don't have to do this. I'm choosing to do this. This is, you know, I really have this freedom. You know, if you interpret that as irony, then wow, what an enlightened age we're living in, that all these teenagers even recognize the absurd and yet sext each other, sexting. Can still engage in whatever their pursuits are.
And believe in Jesus. They're even ironic Christians.
Oh, I'm gonna make one last comment about that. So I don't know what it's like where you live. I had to adjust moving to Texas to the idea that people went to church. Lots of people I know go to church every week, and that very unironically Christian, some Baptists, some others, you know. But, you know, I mentioned earlier that talking about God is dead and we're kind of living in this postmodern world or whatever, you wouldn't know it around me. So I'm speaking from my own sort of within the confines of the ivory tower experience, and it's certainly not the way life works on a daily basis, even in Austin, which is very, very much not at all like many other places in Texas or even the rest of Texas. But anyway, just when you're talking about,
I think God nationwide too. Actually, you'd have to go to Europe really to get that ivory tower experience outside of it.
That's true.
Of an ivory tower.
Everyone's a philosopher.
Oh, all right. Well, let's wrap this up. Thanks for both of you for doing this. And
that was fun.
Good night, everyone. Hey, make sure, you audience people, that you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to listen to our other episodes. Subscribe to this on iTunes if you haven't already, or some other service that maybe will try to take over the mantle from iTunes if you're listening to this 200 years in the future.
Yes.
We have a Facebook discussion group. You can give us some feedback. You can send us messages individually. You can tell us topics that you think we should cover. We put links to all of the readings, at least the best electronic versions we can track down of these things, on the website, and it will make you very happy. In fact, you should join the Facebook group and send invitations for others to join it so you can feel like you're part of an anonymous they. Join us next time for a discussion of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics Books 1 and 2. Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
My friends, please don't desert us. Though you may recall the many things that hurt us, though you've forgotten what it means to wish for anything at all, and you've forgotten what it felt like to be subject to a call that doesn't tempt you from this armpit of a world. My friends, please stay around, please. Please don't levitate away, stay on the ground, please. Though you've forgotten how to care, if you're young enough for air, there is still use for you. We all have use for you. Don't let us down, please. My friends, please hold on tightly. When your life bucks you around, it's so unsightly. But if you're smarter than a lox, your place is not yet in a box. So please beware your darkest edging and the darkness that it mocks. My friend, please don't desert me. Though your presence in this world may well subvert me, if we try to shake you off, please don't take personally the scoff. We're just afraid of your demeanor, but your inside is still soft. My friends, don't you get off here. There's so many things to hold you, though they're not clear. Please hold on till you pull through, and I'll do anything for you. There is still love for you. There is still love for you. Somewhere around here. My friends, please don't desert us. Though you may recall the many things that hurt us, but just please stick around and stay out of that dark ground. That would be nice. I promise that would be nice. I promise that would be nice.